what's his name?
Sky, the UFO synopsis. Now here's your host, DeAndrew.
And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is Peter Robbins. Peter Robbins is one of the best-known investigative writers and speakers on the subject of UFOs and their implications. He's been involved in this field for more than 30 years as a researcher, investigator, writer, lecturer, activist, and author. A regular fixture on radio programs around the country, he has also appeared as a guest on and been consultant to numerous television shows and documentaries, and is also co-author of the British bestseller Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. The Rendlesham Forest incident is one of the reasons Peter has joined me as my guest this evening. In Suffolk, England, at the Woodbridge Community Hall on Tuesday, December 28th, will be the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident 30th Anniversary Conference. John Burroughs and Jim Peniston will be speaking at this event. Also in attendance, will be Linda Moulton Howe, Nick Pope, eyewitness Larry Warren, and our good friend Peter. Peter has been a guest several times on Eye to the Sky, and he is always one of my favorite guests to interview. And once again, it is my great pleasure to welcome Mr. Peter Robbins as my guest. And Peter, as we were saying before we went live, there's something that you would like to let our listeners know.
Yeah. First, hi, Dee. Good to hear your voice again. And hi, David. I know you're back there running the machines. Dee and I were just talking about something very sad that happened earlier this week. A good colleague and a very special guy in UFO studies, Dr. Robert LeLouver, passed away very suddenly on Monday. Robert, we're going to spend a couple of minutes just talking about him, but we all decided we wanted this show dedicated to him. Robert was a professor of psychology at University of Montana Great Falls campus, and took not quite an early retirement, but went on kind of semi-retirement so that he and his wife, Lima, could relocate to Roswell, New Mexico, and he could pursue his interest in this subject. And as you know, one more psychologist who just also happens to be a professor, they're just so valuable in our area of study, and there was nobody better than Robert. He knew his subject. He was so well-spoken. He was a true gentleman. He was my co-organizer of this past summer's Roswell UFO Symposium. And for me, he made me look really good by doing almost all of the work. I'm here in New York, and he's on the ground in Roswell. And I think anybody that attended would tell you that it was a brilliant two-day symposium. And for some of your listeners who were in Denver later in July for the annual MUFON symposium, they had the privilege of hearing Robert give a very important paper on statistical aspects of abduction studies. And there will be a service at his and his wife's church on Monday morning in Roswell. And I know he was a guest on Eye to the Sky at least once, right?
Just once, yes.
Well, I'm glad he was on once, that's for sure.
Well, and as I was saying before we went live, David and I, oh gosh, just within the last 2 or 3 weeks, had been thinking, you know, we should get him back on to get an update on the study that he had been doing in collaboration with numerous other people on various aspects of the UFO topic. You know, and then to hear this news today is really, really saddened me.
Yeah. I had the pleasure of spending time with him last year and his wife, Lima, after the events that captivate that part of the Southwest for those 4 days. And we had a grand time. And this past July, once we had finished with the symposium, I stayed on for another week as their house guest, and I, you know, you almost didn't want to go to sleep because we just had an awful lot of fun, and we're talking a blue streak, and took a number of great road trips together over the past couple of years, including out to Carlsbad Caverns and to both White Sands and the White Sands Missile Proving Ground. And I had never been to any of these places before, and they quite blew my mind. And Robert and Lima were perfect companions and just the most wonderful hosts. And I think sometimes, you know, there are so many ironies in life. There is a special place in my heart for true iconoclasts, people who destroy your preconceived notions. And, you know, all of this understood about Robert is probably his most giant passion outside of his marriage and ufology, who knows, was the Indianapolis 500. He was a total race car fanatic. And I don't think you knew that, but...
No, I didn't.
No. And at the height of our work this spring with the committee in Roswell pulling together this huge multi-thousand person event, Robert took off for a couple of weeks. Again, he's more than allowed. He worked his butt off, and, you know, they're all volunteers. But he went out to Indianapolis, and as he has done many years in the past, I understand, was in the stands for every single race. And also tremendously proud. Le Louvre, very unusual name. I think it's French. But he, I know, is very proud of his Irish heritage as well. And, again, it doesn't, it's a catchphrase, and it rarely applies, but Robert Le Louvre was a scholar and a gentleman and an awfully nice guy and such an important person in ufology, a perfect example of somebody in the field who was far from being the best known name, but we had nobody better, you know, as a person, as a presence, as an investigator, and we will miss him. We will miss him on a number of levels.
Well, I have to admit that I was very, very impressed with the work that he had done in organizing the group of people he did. He had given me and David, had sent a pretty good sized packet outlining, you know, his area of study and all the other people that were working. Well, Karen Dolan was one of the people on his list, and with her work on television imagery for of aliens for children, geared towards children.
Yes.
And also a Catholic priest on the religious implications and just covering the whole gamut.
In fact, one of something that probably will remain unfinished unless things change is Robert had been working quite hard the last few years on putting together a book of essays, chapters that were all contributed by individuals in the field. And you mentioned Karen, and Rich were also very taken aback by this. And I went on Karen's show just to start it for a few minutes last night to talk about Robert as well. But she was the first person that Robert asked to contribute to this book. And then Rich and I and quite a number of others followed. And it's a shame. It is a shame that it had not been completed at the time of his death.
I hope someone does, because if I remember correctly, the material that he had sent us was material he had collected.
Exactly.
So at that point in time, that was been, oh gosh, about a year or so ago.
Yeah. When the dust settles a bit, and ironically, he and Lima had just sold their home, and were going to be relocating further east. So perhaps I can chat with her sometime in the future about this, and maybe we can make this a reality. But our hearts and our condolences go out to Lima and the rest of Robert's family, and many of us loved him, and many others were impressed and will remember him, his kindness, and his contributions. And life goes on.
Oh, definitely. But he will be missed.
Yeah. But we'll pick this up again at a future show, and I will let you know anything else I learn, as well as your listeners.
That would be awesome. I'd love to find out if the book ever does come to fruition.
Yeah.
I'd love to read it.
Well, one thing to suggest, if you have a show scheduled for some time in the next few months that for one reason or another is just difficult to do, rerun the show that you recorded with him. I think that would be wonderful, and let folks know so as many people as possible can hear
Definitely.
Him speak. Also, for anybody that is interested, DVD copies of the great talk that he gave in Denver in later July for MUFON Symposium are available through MUFON, and all you need to do is contact their main office in Colorado, and I'm sure you can work something out there.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. I'd love to. That's another one I'd like to hear, too,
mm-hmm.
as well. Okay, getting back to where you're going to be here in a few days from now, like,
mm-hmm.
About a week from now, which I'm so jealous.
And you have every right to be. That's right. I'm going back to England, actually, in a week and a half. And I will be there until January 4th. Like so many of us, my back is just to the wall financially, even though the big money in ufology is what we're all after, and I'm swimming in it here. And this is not the most advantageous time to take a trip overseas for a couple of weeks. But, I almost found myself laughing at myself. There's absolutely no other place in the cosmos that I have to be next month. I mean later
this month.
Yeah, right. So what we have going, as you've noted there, is an event, a symposium, a conference as it's being billed, will take place in the town of Woodbridge, which is in Suffolk, and, oh gosh, probably less than a dozen, 10 miles from the sites of December 1980. This will be a real first. I think it's certainly the first time that John Burroughs and Jim Peniston, both very important witnesses to this seminal event, have spoken together in England. Linda Howe, a documentary, award-winning documentary filmmaker and extraordinary contributor to a number of fields in paranormal studies, who's been working so diligently with John the past few years. I think the lion's share of the program will be given over to them. But myself and Larry Warren and Nick Pope, and I expect a few other folks who were involved or as obsessed and as research-wise involved as I am, will be there as well. It's also funny how things work out. The gentleman who is putting this together, Gordon Godger, put together a talk for Larry and I in Woodbridge about 13 years ago when Left at Eastgate was a big bestseller there, and had approached us about doing a talk, and Larry, bless his heart, basically just said, no, contact Jim and John, let them be the stars of this one. And so the big focus will be on them. And I'm very pleased to say that the event itself will not it'll be £6 for entry and no comps. So if you have friends in southeastern England, tell them immediately to get there. The most important thing, though, aside from the content, is that Ipswich, which is the larger town some miles over, they have a series of children's hospices called the Treehouse Children's Hospices, and this will be an entire fundraiser for them. And we're having really cool T-shirts made up of a flying lighthouse and that great Mulder phrase underneath it, I want to believe.
How cool.
Yeah, and all of that money will go to this important event. We will also be taking people out into the forest and bringing them through a series of locations associated with the different nights of the event.
Now that's the part that I would really love to go.
Well, I'll tell you, David, right now it's still coming together. I'm hoping we'll have at least one videographer out with us, whether it's day or night, whenever it is, on these walks, and that we can make that footage available as a DVD. So I'll keep you posted on that. Right now it does look like this conference, so to say, will be filmed. So once again, we hopefully will have a record of that. And my hope is that we allow as many anybody that wants to film it and tape record it and just get it out there, but that we professionally film it and that any profits on those sales also go to Treehouse Children's Hospice. But I am getting out there early and staying late. The event itself is on the 28th of December, and God, this is just terrible to tell you, but I'm not flying to Suffolk. I'm flying to Liverpool.
And oh, you're going to see Larry, of course.
Absolutely, and I will land at the, bless its heart, the John Lennon International Airport early on Thursday morning the 16th, spend the next few days with very good friends there and with Larry and his young son Dennis, and make our usual Beatles pilgrimage and go have a beer at the Cavern and walk the walk and hang out, and then probably about the 20th travel overnight down to London and then make my way out to Suffolk and spend more than a week out there. For any of you readers of Left at East Gate, you may remember this wonderful family who ran a bed and breakfast that Larry and I stayed in repeatedly, who over the years have become real family for me, and all of their, two out of three sons have stayed with us when they've been over in the States, and I continue to look forward to our times together. So I'll be out with them about 4 miles from their original location. We'll have good old-fashioned Christmas together. Head back into London on the 29th and look forward to New Year's in London, and then fly back to New York on the 4th. And hopefully, if you have some broadcast time available in January or early February, I can come back and give you guys an update.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Not a problem. I'd be delighted.
Oh, gosh, I'm so jealous, and you know, my sister...
And you should be.
if my sister knew that I even remotely knew anybody in Liverpool, my sister is the biggest Beatles fan.
Uh-oh, then I'm not sure how you're going to break this to her, but as we all know, the most important things that come about in this quirky field are... the friends that you make, and if you're lucky, getting to visit places that you normally wouldn't. And the other stuff is all gravy as far as I'm concerned. But the people are really the most important thing. The aliens do not tell me what is really going on, even though they seem to tell other people, but I'm hesitant to take them sometimes at face value. But this, for me, is the most fun. And an anecdote here, because we do have some time tonight, and I don't know if I ever told you and David this story. This had to be about 6 or 7 years ago. I was still living in Manhattan, and Larry, who has been living in Liverpool now for a full decade as a true expatriate, is calls me one afternoon, and he's particularly excited on the phone. He says, "You have any copies, spare copies of the book? I'm out." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I want you to send me one, like overnight or, you know, whatever." And my first thought was, well, why do I have to send it so fast? You know, that's expensive. And I said, well, I said, you're not going to believe it. I met somebody and they want to read our book and you want them to read it as soon as possible. And I said, who? And he said, I can't say exactly how he said it because we're on the air. But he said with great excitement, Sir Paul McCartney. And, of course, I must have made a noise that was loud enough that people in my office turned around to see what was going on in my cubicle. And I calmed him down, and what followed was a few days before, Larry was in downtown Liverpool doing whatever he was doing, and he saw this knot of people coming down a street and other people responding to it. And as they got closer, he could see, surrounded by a few security people, a very smiling and animated and waving Paul McCartney. And Larry, who is just beyond belief sometimes to me over the more than 20 years I've known him, he wants to meet somebody, he'll find a way. And he basically said, I just stood there until his eyes happened to go by me, and I raised my hand. And he looked at me, and I said, Sir Paul, do you remember that UFO event that broke in the papers in 1983 that happened down in Suffolk? And McCartney said, yeah, of course. And he said, I was there. I was a witness. It really happened. And Paul said, well, then you've got to come have a glass of wine with me.
How cool.
Yeah, being cool as far as most of us Beatles fans are concerned. And one thing led to another. And Paul and his then wife, Heather, read it. And I understand and enjoyed it. I do know that when I was last over at Christmas time, which was 5 years ago to mark the 25th anniversary, it was doubly special for me because my family, my dad and my sister and brother-in-law and niece and nephew all came over for a week as well. And we had a marvelous time. And that Christmas in Suffolk, I was able to give my brother-in-law a box set of some of Paul's CDs. That the box had been inscribed to Jim on it. And
oh, how cool.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the perks that make up for the Peace Corps wages often associated with ufology.
Definitely.
Now, I don't think we're going to be having tea with Sir Paul on this trip, but I'll see if I can come up with some outlandish fable to feed you when I get back.
Oh, and don't forget those pictures of Stonehenge.
I'm unfortunately, yes, I do owe you some Stonehenge pictures. I wish I could get out there on this trip, but it ain't going to happen. But yeah, the serious part is this 30th anniversary. I think it's particularly important because of our human nature. We're funny creatures, and we associate significant numbers with significant events and pay more attention to them at those moments. And there is quite a focus on Rendlesham, again, appropriately, at this time leading into the 30th anniversary. And although new findings, new witnesses coming forward, and I have been working with somebody who has not come forward yet, who is about to.
How many men and or women have come forward that witnessed one or more nights of this event?
Well, that's a good question. I've never taken a formal count, but as you know, in the updated edition of Left at East Gate, we included a number of excerpts from letters from airmen and other individuals who were directly or indirectly involved in the events of December 1980, confirming their involvement in thanking Larry or, just having a word to him about his extraordinary stubbornness and the best sense of the word in taking this story finally into print after so many years. Right offhand, I'd say there's at least a dozen, but when I say come forward, it may mean as simple as responded to reading a book and wrote a letter and are not interested in speaking at conferences or, you know, getting wired up with this stuff. And if somebody were to come to me right now and say, you know, I was there December 1980, I'm former Air Force, I was aware of it, I saw a little something, I read your book, I heard about the thing that happened, I've watched documentaries, what's your advice to me if I want to come forward? And my first thought would not come from the researcher, investigator, the person who wants all this to come out. It would come from a human being who puts human beings first and say, are you sure you want to do this? And let's think about some of what may blow back on you if you do. Think twice. If you do want to do it, more power to you, and I'll be happy to help. But I'm sure we have at least a dozen folks. I know over the past months, our radio colleague Paul Eno and his son Ben, working out of a CBS affiliate in Rhode Island, have done a series of shows which at different points have had myself, Larry, Nick Pope, Linda Howe, and most important other witnesses, including Jim Peniston, John Burroughs, Charles Halt, Steve LaPlume, who was also on D-Flight with Larry and now lives in China, so I had to time that one well. Timothy Agarik, who was witnessed certain stuff on radar and was aware of things that night. Adrian Bastinza, who plays a central part in this, has never wanted to be a public person in this. He stood next to Larry in Cable Green, that field, the night Larry was involved, when that, you know, they were essentially surrounding this machine of undetermined origin. And he lives quietly in the Southwest, and he has talked to and corresponded with a number of players, though, so he's not completely out of it. I know that Linda has a few more. Again, I have someone who I'm going to bring forward next year, who was not there at the time, but was stationed at RAF Bentwaters, and in fact was transferred off the base a few months beforehand, but knew John Burroughs and a number of other people who were involved, has a very interesting background in his military service, and also a phenomenal UFO, I'll call it a sighting, much more in his after the Air Force, but I'm off on a tangent here. Main thing is that, yeah, this month, is the 30th anniversary of Great Britain's best-known and best-documented UFO event, and certainly one of the most important, significant, and relevant UFO events in history, bar none.
I agree. There is a call out for anybody who witnessed any part of these events to come forward. How would they contact?
Oh, well, there's,
you know,
a number of ways.
Or
even easier. John and Jim and Larry and I and a number of other people, Nick Pope, of course, all have Facebook pages. And there is a Facebook page. I'm trying to remember the...
81st Security Police of Bentwaters, I think, is the...
Justice for the 81st, I forget the exact. But if you go onto Facebook, it's either Bentwaters Security Police or Justice for the 81st.
For the 81st.
Yeah, just join that page. And... you know, you can offer up your comments or your memories or your accounts directly. I think John basically is overseeing it, so you could send him a message, or you could simply post them if you really have decided that you want to be public with this. What I had started to say before is we're funny about numbers, and the fact that this is the 30th anniversary means that we have a maximum opportunity for attention to be focused on it, and I don't predict things, but I can tell you without question that this will be all over the British press, and there have already been a number of articles, a new documentary, etc., and it will be a busy week on location there, to be sure. But it will be more attention focused on the subject, ironically, unfortunately, whatever you want to say, in the public realm for another 5 or 10 years until we hit another quote-unquote significant number anniversary. People won't be flocking to the 31st anniversary, although those of us that are involved in the subject will never let go of this one. It's much too important, and there are still many living witnesses who may well go on record. With the stuff that's happening with WikiLeaks right now, it makes me wonder at some point maybe that will be something that will be relevant to moving the disclosure process along.
You know, I was thinking that myself. I was sitting here reading Richard Dolan's book, A.D. After Disclosure, and I got to thinking, holy...
Yeah.
Well, this is live radio. Mm. Holy cow!
Yeah.
Could this be the disclosure trigger?
Well, I think that there are a number of scenarios, options, possibilities, but a major leak of undeniable documentation is something, you know, this week. Another thing I'd add to my list of stuff to zoom through with you tonight was this really interesting announcement about the discovery of this new seeming non-earthly life form that has been discovered, which is simple, but it is not a carbon-based life form. It is an arsenic-based life form. And on the same day, an announcement is made that there are like 3 times the number of stars that we thought there were that we can, you know, corroborate on some level, which of course, just by running a basic set of numbers, means that there are then again that many more times arithmetically for that right combination of planet or planetoid distance from its star, building blocks of life, or if you're theologically inclined, you know, a creation event. In any case, I thought the coupling of those stories in one day was another interesting one, and the fact that, you know, astrobiologists are all excited that they have found this new form of life that they feel originates off Earth, and we're saying, turn the heck around and look at this gray guy who wants to shake your hand. you know, I'm speaking in silly terms, of course, but I know you understand the frustration that we have with their resistance, I think, overall, to even look at the best UFO-related literature. It is just like a closed circle. It can't be, therefore it isn't, therefore it's something else. Therefore, number one, I'm a busy professional. I certainly don't have time to waste reading books about flying saucers and abductions by aliens. It's nonsense, and we all know it. Of course. Plus, I'm a professional. I've got my reputation to think of. And if there was anything to it, we'd know about it, blah, 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 blah. And yet, one more kind of cry in the wilderness of, oh, we found a new life form, and there sure are a lot of stars out there.
Definitely. I was got some questions here from our virtual auditorium that I think are very relevant.
Great.
This first one is from Tall Dwarf, and he asks, any activity in the Rendlesham area lately or recently?
Great question, and tune in the next appearance that I have on the show, hopefully next month. What I do know is that statistically, UFO sightings in the Suffolk, Norfolk area and in this corner of East Anglia, Suffolk, are pretty much statistically above the norm, that there have been an historic higher number of incidents of serious sightings and UFO-related events there than in many other parts of Great Britain. But I don't have any specifics for you. I'll certainly ask around, and I'm sure whatever has happened fairly recently will be there for discussion.
Okay. Having read, you know, Lefty Skate, 2 editions of it now. actually, I haven't read the third one, which is the advanced copy yet, but I got that one tucked away. Having read Left at Eastgate, where this session where you talk about you and Larry going out into the woods and see these strange, you know, lights floating around.
Yep.
You know, and I could just see you just like going, okay, I think I'm going to go back to the bed and breakfast.
Back? I never wanted to leave. I just wanted to watch British television that night and stay warm and cozy. It was one of the most memorable nights of my life and one of the most unnerving. Yeah.
And it was more than one night, too, wasn't it, you guys saw that?
Our event was just one night. The damnedest thing, though, was that it was the first night of our first visit. And that sounds nuts. I mean, it sounded so insulting to me because we weren't saying we saw a little light in the night sky. We saw more like 30 anomalous objects, and we each had a recorder in our hand, and we're doing our best to say what we were seeing, and in some cases, feeling or thinking. It was several dozen things, some, you know, zigzagging pinpoints of light to fully articulate discs, including one that came down in the woods and lit it up, all without a sound, and something that appeared in the far end of the field that we were watching from that brought me close to shock, I think. On a funny tangent here, Larry, after the fact, apologized to me because he had been saying you're going to see him when we go over. And I thought, yeah, right. You know, give me a break. I know I take you seriously, but don't. And our first night, oh my God. And he said in so many words, however you want to handle this is okay with me. If you don't want to mention it, that's fine. If you want to talk about it a lot, if you want to talk about it in passing. And I wrestled with it as an investigative writer and as somebody who values my own integrity. I felt immediately to ignore it was absolutely lying by omission. By the same token, if I ended a paragraph on that day, if I ended the chapter on that day by saying, oh yeah, on that night when we walked out to the base, we saw like 37 UFOs and then wake up the next morning, you can't do that either. And so I ended up with a headset on for, I think, more than 2 months. I listened and re-listened in great part because of the distortions. There's tremendous wind blowing that night, and being a bit of a novice, I hadn't realized it was blowing across the mics, and it sounded like special effects from an old movie or something. I also knew that I would be alleging something extremely controversial, with my only witness being a very already controversial witness, and that anybody was right to call me on it. And so I recreated our conversation that night, working strictly from those audio tapes. And I should say, some years after the book came out, I was contacted by two guys who were not law enforcement guys, but their thing was voice stress analysis. They did it. They had the apparatus. It was sounded like more than a hobby, but they inquired as to whether or not I would be willing to allow cassette copies of our conversation to be put through this. VSA technology is used by quite a number of police departments in this country. Justice Department uses it. I know the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York uses it. And, other military and police organizations. It registers stress in the human voice. And if Larry and I had been working from a script or lying or, you know, just making believe it was happened, we would have been destroyed on this. And in fact, I loaned them our first generation tapes, and they were corroborated. And in a way, I'm glad that happened. It had been in my thoughts, but nobody did until they did. Yeah, we had a multiple sighting event, whatever you want to call it, on our very first night of our first trip in February of 88. And I'm very pleased to report that on about 15 subsequent visits to that part of England, I have not had UFO sightings, which is fine with me.
Here, our next question is from David. And he sent me a little bit thing to add to the end of it here. His question is, has anyone found out whether or not that idiot skeptic from the BBC, is going to be there or not. Last I heard, he was all talk and backed out of attending. And he put in later, I believe the idiot is named Ian Ridpath.
Ian is not really with the BBC, to the best of my knowledge. At the time of the events in December 80, Ian was, I think, a ranger with the Forestry Commission. And he is the person responsible for coming up with the theory that the impressions that found in the soil, they were circular impressions, they were equilateral triangular, they were pressed into the soil. Below areas where forest canopy had been ripped out, branches brought down, as things came down from the sky through the trees and landed on the ground. Each one of these impressions that Mr. Ridpath addressed had elevated background beta and gamma radiation counts that could not be accounted for in any realistic way. And what he theorized was that either chickens or rabbits had created the circles. And as far as I was concerned, I can accept that if he can present chickens or rabbits that understand equilateral triangles and can replicate them on a number of locations in the same general area, create perfect circles, create the impression that something weighed several tons and pressed down into the soil, and are ever so slightly radioactive. Ian, this has been his little 15 minutes of fame that have stretched out now for almost 30 years. And my understanding also is that he will not be choosing to attend. If he does, I for one will welcome him and call him a pinhead. Some such thing. It would be funny
David,
if it wasn't so insulting.
David says that he would punch him out, but, you know.
Yeah, well, that's good, too.
I leave that to Larry.
Yeah, oh, gee, Will. No, Ian, I think, has cast his own... I don't think he's taken that seriously by most folks, certainly by anybody that spends a modest amount of time looking into what is actually corroborated about these events, which are as well documented as anything in, you know, a major felony investigation. These are factual events with all kinds of evidence that we're talking about here. As I think I told you, you know, the other thing, of course, is that, the men thought they saw a lighthouse. And, of course, there is the Orford Ness Lighthouse about 10 miles from there or so. And I have been out to that field at night repeatedly over the years, and at that time of year, and with the leaves down, you can, on a good night, see that flash in the distance through the trees on a regular, you know, basis as it rotates down by the nest. But to even suggest that highly trained military specialists, many of them security police officers, specialty trained in working around nuclear ordnance and specialty terrorist training and what have you, that they confuse a small rotating light through the trees in the distance with a landed craft of undetermined origin or of lights in the night sky moving seemingly under intelligent control that were in no way conventional aircraft. Once again, it would be funny if it wasn't so unbelievably insulting to these men who saw what they saw and reported it.
Well, what color is the light from the Orford Ness Lighthouse?
Oh, it's just an off-white. And again, there was an attempt some years ago to synchronize the flash of the light with reactions on Colonel Halt's excerpt from his tape recording.
Mm-hmm.
And it was... I saluted them for giving it a shot, and in fact, for a period of a minute or so, it actually seemed to sync. But then it went out of sync because they were not looking at that. They were looking at something wholly other that was coming in over them. and then shining beams of light down literally to their feet.
Well, they were the reason why I was asking for the color of the Orford Lighthouse light is because the object that Halt and his team saw, didn't they say that it was red and had like a black circle in it that almost made it look like an eye?
Yes, that's correct. That's absolutely correct. So, again, this is something as old as the subject. If we throw up a bunch of half-assed facts, whoever is going to really look into it, and if you speak with authority and just keep telling the same distortion or overt lie over and over, you know, after a while people will lose interest, of course. Not everyone in the world, to put it mildly, is as interested in the subjects at hand as we and many folks in your listening audience are. And it works. It works repeatedly. It's a simple political technique that is used on us, we the people, all the time, and certainly no more than recent years. It is a shame, but this one will never go away. And as I've said on numerous occasions, if Congress were ever to recover the courage to look into this subject in an organized way by committee, this is the case that could break it. This is the one that could break it open. And literally all of the witnesses are alive. They are subpoenaable should an investigation ever happen. There is so much documentation, military and otherwise, so many witnesses, military and civilian, and an extraordinarily surprising amount of physical evidence to back these allegations up. So the fact that, you know, January 1st, it will be moving toward the 31st anniversary of Rendlesham, will not sway those of us that feel this is our best shot, and also a great education case, so to say, because when you study it, as you know, it has aspects of almost every area of study and interest that we come upon across the board in UFO studies, from trace case stuff to abduction to missing time, cover-up, you name it. The Rendlesham Forest incident, also known as the Bentwaters UFO incident, has it all.
Well, then the Bentwaters base itself has had, gosh, quite a history of UFO involvement.
Well,
I mean, the military base itself.
Yes.
You know, the
1956
planes launched
event.
From it. Yeah, exactly. Yes, and wasn't Milton Torres?
Oh, yes, of course.
Was
That's
he
right.
out of there as well?
That I don't know. But Milton, of course, was a pilot in a very well-known UFO incident. He was based not far from RAF Bentwaters. And just when you said Bentwaters at that moment, I said, ah, another little neuron has sprung into work, and I am about to report to you something new and exciting. I spoke with Larry Warren, I think, two nights ago.
Okay.
And Larry told me that, well, something has happened that we find intriguing. We have always maintained that there is a huge, highly secured facility below the Twin Base complex there in Suffolk, and it plays an important part in the story because that is where Larry and a number of men who were involved as witnesses preceding that were taken against their will, some chemically subdued, some in other ways, and held for up to a day and a half, possibly 2 days in some cases, and put through some kind of Disneyland on acid sort of programming as far as I've been able to reconstruct. But, you know, a lot of people, just that phrase, I know I smirked the first time I heard it like 25, 30 years ago of secret underground base. It just sounds so Buck Rogers and so corny and so loopy. Well, you know, it's standard military technology for over half a century. There is more going on underground than we can even imagine. Of course, there's nothing under Phoenix, so that part of the United States, so rest easy as far as you guys go. But the fact is, RAF Bentwaters was decommissioned as a base in the early 1990s, and it was purchased by a local family, obviously, of some means. And it's several hundred acres, as I recall, and it's slowly being developed for civilian applications, although a lot of it is just, you know, kind of a frozen Cold War museum. It's a decommissioned military base that was very well cared for. And last year when I visited there and walked through it, you know, you see signs that were painted back at the height of the Cold War that are in beautiful shape, and it's got quite a vibe and nobody home. Anyway, so again, since 92 or so, this base is in the hands of a private family. And less than a week ago, they discovered on their property an access to a series of underground passages, quite massive and beautifully constructed, and large areas. I think that they have found some of the areas where nuclear ordnance may have been stored, as well as aircraft, like our SR-71, which was not stored in a hangar, as I recall. It was underground, the ones that they had there. But they have found a huge area. I still feel, even though I know next to nothing about it, that this is not where Larry and the other men were taken, which I feel is considerably below wherever they've come into. But this is a great confirmation of something we included in the newer version of Left at Eastgate, an interview with a surveyor who worked under government contract on the base on and off for years, and found blueprints, schematics for the underground passageway of tunnels. George Nursey is his name. I don't know if he still lives in the Suffolk area, but he gave a wonderful interview, much of which we included in the book. So this is new stuff, and you can bet I will move heaven and earth to make contact with this family in a couple of weeks. I think we have one major mutual friend, which I will play to advantage if I can. And trust me, if I can get down there, I will. But any information I learn, I will pass on when we get together again on the air.
Yeah, it'd be kind of interesting if somebody gets the wise idea to turn up the weapons storage bunkers into kind of housing, you know?
Yeah, I remember also an interview that I include part of with somebody who I can't give their name because they, at the time, were still a contractor working with the Air Force with a very high security access. And they had talked about the fact that they had serviced a network of tunnels that they had been told, beautifully tiled, were for water. But they were big enough to drive vehicles through, and that's, you don't need like that kind of water in that area of England. And they were also, which kind of blew the cover in a way, they were electrically lit, which water really doesn't need lights in the ceiling to find its way to where it's going. So there is, you know, it's just a matter of how deep it goes, allegorically and actually. Mm. But now the jig is up on at least this first level of underground structures. And not that it's been a secret. You know about it if you're there. And one thing George pointed out to me, the engineer, some years back, was if you walked to such and such a point on such and such a road, you could see the subsidence. You could see how over the years it had settled, and you could see a shape that vaguely outlined where that tunnel passed through that particular area. It had been there so long. Yeah, and George's schematics indicated that several thousand people could be accommodated. So this is not small stuff. Perhaps there's some kind of adjunctive retreat in that area underground for movers and shakers coming out of London by some kind of underground transport in the event of national emergency or, you know, cultural meltdown or what have you.
I agree. On this point, we need to stop for a break.
Yeah.
And when we come back, I'd kind of like to delve into some of the ideas that that you and Barry have of possible sites for cloudbusters. I'm right, cloudbusters. That I find intriguing. Mm. And we'll get into that when we come back to the break. So we'll be back here in 8 to 9 minutes with Peter Robbins here on Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
You chipmunks, ready to sing your song?
Okay, we are. Yeah, let's sing it now.
Okay, Simon?
Okay.
Okay, Theodore?
Okay.
Okay, Alvin? Alvin?
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We'll go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Constantly watch the sky, wondering if there's something out there.
In fear of things going bump in the night.
This Truth Radio brings you headfirst into the world of the paranormal with the latest news and interviews with the paranormal elite.
With hosts Jordan Klein and Nick Queen, you are sure to be consumed in the world of ghosts, UFOs, cryptozoology, conspiracy theories, and the unknown.
So check out Whispers Radio every Tuesday night, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Central. And give us a call, 1-866-514-1600.
Visit us at www.whispersradio.com.
Are you interested in a radio program that focuses on the deeper aspects of the UFO topic? Would you like to explore the facts and truths of what ufology and UFO research are all about? Then please join us here every Saturday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central for Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, with your host, D. Andrew, right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. And remember, UFO research is not a belief system.
This radio station broadcasts programs dealing with UFOs, aliens, New Age, and the paranormal. Check out our great lineup. All show times are based on Central Time. This is a live broadcast of the chat and support group for alien abductees on Pal Talk. Thank you for tuning in to the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Gia Scott. I'm the host of this really cool little radio program on Tuesday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. It's called The Dawn of Shades. I bring in a wide variety of guests, and we talk about all sorts of things. Some of them are authors, some of them are experiencers, but it's all paranormal. Do tune in to The Dawn of Shades from 7 to 9 p.m. Tuesdays, and you can always at giascott.com.
A radio program that looks at the UFO topic from a fresh perspective. Sound interesting? Then join us here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Friday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, 10 p.m. Central for The Joyner Report, hosted by journalist and researcher Angela Joyner.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICAR, that's International Community for Alien Research, www.icar1.com. I should know, I'm Irish.
Synopsis. Now here's your host, D. Andrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, D. Andrew, and tonight my guest is Peter Robbins. Now, Peter, before we went to the break, I brought up Wilhelm Reich's Cloudbusters and the possibility that there could have been some of these at Bent Waters.
Yes.
It just fascinates me. I you know, even before I knew about Wilhelm Reich,
yeah.
I had seen, you know, some material on the Cloudbusters, but I didn't know, you know, the origins of them until hearing you speak about him at the Crash Retrieval Conference.
Where we met.
5 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, this was purely my contention, although, well, that's not really true. What happened was I was very involved with Reich's work when I was younger, and in fact, my therapist for 6 or 7 years had been Dr. Reich's first assistant, and in that period of time, I got to meet so many people that had worked with him. This goes back some years. In any case, Reich had developed technology that could assist the atmosphere in clarifying itself, and used properly, responsibly, and under the right conditions, could break droughts, and in fact is used for that by Dr. James DeMeo, who works out of Ashland, Oregon, and Green Springs Research Laboratory, and has worked on contract for a number of governments around the world to do just that. Reich is as controversial a figure in the world of science as you can find from most folks, but many people who have heard his name have read about him and never read his work, and he was a true genius, I think, and his work, which really was nothing more than the study of how energy functions in all realms of the living and non-living. How does this all tie in with our UFO story here? Reich had developed this technology in the early 1950s, and there was no question about the fact that where he was doing testing with it in rural Maine, in the Rangeley area in the south, it attracted UFO activity. They also changed the weather patterns of that part of the United States beyond any doubt. And the same thing happened in 1956 when Reich brought the technology out to the Tucson area and broke every pre-existing weather record that had ever been kept in that part of the United States. However, he found that if he trained a device on one of these UFOs, it would seem to destabilize it. This is not the kind of subject that is best communicated in somebody talking for a few minutes on the radio, and anybody who is serious about learning more about the subject, I would direct them to Reich's writings specifically and his final book, Contact with Space, which delineates all of his weather work and the multiply witnessed UFO activity it attracted, not to mention his theories and thoughts on UFOs and their implications, were in a book called Contact with Space that was published posthumously shortly after he died in 1957 in an edition of 500. So it's a highly sought-after title. However, it has been reprinted and is available, I understand, through the bookstore of the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine. Anyway, getting back to Rendlesham, not long, and I mean a matter of days, before Larry and I were scheduled to fly to England for our very first of what went on to be many research trips there. This would have been February of 1988. We were giving a talk out at Princeton, New Jersey, with Bud Hopkins and Antonio Neas on UFOs, and it was something we were all looking forward to because it was for physicians, scientists, people involved in Reich studies, psychiatrists. Anyway, Larry was going through a brochure, a fundraising brochure for the American College of Orgonomy, orgonomy being the name Reich gave to the science of the study of energy. And there was a photograph of a cloudbuster in there, and they can be considerable size, you know, a realistic size one can be on a trailer behind a normal vehicle or even mounted on a pickup truck. Anyway, he said, oh, we had these on base. And I thought that couldn't be the case. And I called them on it, and they would have had big cables coming out of the back. Yep, they had them. Well, you needed wells to operate them, removing water. No, you had that too. There were wells strategically placed all over the area, including by the landing areas, the tarmacs. And he said that he remembered one that was parked by the one of the runways, but it was much bigger than the ones that I saw the pictures of in the brochure. And that it was on a flatbed, and that it was trailer mounted and painted olive drab. And I was just dumbstruck. The implications were pretty shattering. This is England, after all, in the southeast. The weather is not great overall. We theorized that they could have been used to keep an area clear for aircraft, which is not out of the question. Or that it was being deployed as a possible experimental type of weapon, which I feel unfortunately was either the case, or it was tested under very poor control, and they created a weather situation there that we discuss in depth in Left at Eastgate that brought down 1.3 million trees in Suffolk in a matter of 3 or 4 hours. And without a drop of rain, even though it was called a hurricane, which would not have been the case. And we include some pictures of the forest destruction in Left at Eastgate. I do know, and I include in the updated edition of the book, a corroboration by Dr. DeMeo, who is a central figure in this very rarefied area of technology, that he has similar reports from areas outside of other military bases in Europe, Scandinavia. And I don't know, but I think that it is certainly very, very possible. The bottom line was I decided, once again, Larry said it's your ball, that we would not print any reference to this unless I found other witnesses. Bringing Wilhelm Reich into this story, it's just suicidal. We've got enough controversial stuff on our plate without introducing somebody that many people think they know something about and all bad or crazy. And so few of them really have read anything by him or have any sense of the importance of his contributions to science. And sure enough, about 2 years later, we spent time with a couple, a married couple. Both had been stationed at Bentwaters and Woodbridge. Both remembered the same apparatus. I was stuck, and so we went to press with it, and I would never back down from it now. I absolutely am convinced that there was this technology out there, and we do also know from the historic record that Reich, who was very patriotic and kept the Air Force and the White House appraised of certain developments in his work in the 1950s. And even that, to digress for a moment, was considered proof of being delusional. Who writes the White House or the CIA and the Air Force? And the Air Force had schematics of these devices. In fact, they turned up in a folder that was used to help prosecute him under a very bogus FDA claim of being a quack, which he was anything but. And I can only direct people to my papers on this subject, to works by Wilhelm Reich, especially now that Contact with Space is back in print, and to Left at Eastgate, where I discuss the situation in some depth.
I have an interesting question here for you.
Yeah.
From our virtual auditorium. And this one's from Cartoonist, and he asks, shiny objects over New York City, UFO displays, UFO delays Chinese flights with increasing UFO sightings. Isn't it about time for disclosure? Also, how should it happen?
huge, huge questions. Yeah, it was time for disclosure 63 years ago when things hit the fan under President Truman in the summer of 1947. If you think about an historic lie like the one that we're dealing with here, and you think of the layers of calcification that an oyster adds to a piece, a little particle of sand that's made its way into the oyster to keep that piece of sand from irritating it. That is the basis of a pearl. And these layers of irritation, in terms of, you know, allegorical ones, I think it makes it more difficult to divest yourself of all of the lies, because the first truth has to be that we're not only lying, we've been lying to you for 36 years. And it doesn't matter whether we've been Democratic, Republican, conservative, liberal. We're liars, and who wants to be the first to admit that? How will it happen, though, is a wonderful question. I write about that fairly extensively in a paper you may actually have posted on your website, the paper that I gave at last year's MUFON symposium on politics, human nature, and religion and UFOs, which I would invite you to read. And maybe one of the best things you could read right now, cartoonist, is the book that I just finished reading and that Dee and David are reading right now, which is Rich Dolan and Bruce Zabel's AD After Disclosure. That might answer some of your questions on how it may happen. Well, definitely will answer.
And so far, I'm like about a third of the way through it, and it's a great book.
Oh, they're good. They're just perfect for each other in this, and I think this book's power is going to build up over this coming year, that word of mouth will be good on it, that it will cross over into the realm of more general readership, that both of these very interesting guys are going to be giving it maximum media exposure that they're able. Richard from the ufological and historic point of view, Bruce with his roots in the entertainment business, and I think that this one really is going to make a mark, and I'm just very proud of Rich. He is becoming one of our greatest assets, isn't he?
Oh, you know it, and you know me, I'm real big on the historic aspects of ufology, and I mean, you know, who better to write on the history of all things ufological than Rich Dolan, who, if I remember correctly, it was a runner-up for Rhodes Scholar, and if I believe correctly, his area of the study was Cold War history.
You're absolutely right on both counts. That is correct. And he was merrily on his way to pursuing a PhD, and I'm guessing either a teaching or writing career, and I'm sure it would have been a knockout, too, when a FOIA that he had put together to pull together information to back up whatever aspect of his thesis he was working on came with a bunch of declassified UFO documents that he, as I recall, had not requested because he didn't know they existed. And that, I think, is when Richard's academic career jumped the rails, as they say, and careened off into ufology, and thank goodness, say I.
Definitely. I mean, I was just reading in there this morning, and there was a couple of holy cow moments, and I would say holy cow, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And David would go, what? And I'd have to read it to him. And he'd go, holy cow, you know, back and forth. You know, I mean, he picks up stuff that it's like, how in the hell does he find all this stuff? You know?
Well,
I mean,
that's why they call it research.
Definitely.
And I should say, I think it was in the mid-90s, I was working away on some aspect of Left at Eastgate, but I was doing my research at the main branch of the New York City Public Library. And you know how it is, sometimes a word gets stuck in your head and you just sort of can't quite get it out. And it was research. And I had this tiny little 15-watt epiphany when it just kind of hit me between the eyes that the derivation of the word was so wonderfully simple. It simply means to look again, to research. And there you have it. Really good researchers, they just are the best. They get their teeth into something, and they will follow that thread through as many archives and libraries and out-of-print books and unpublished interviews and declassified documents that they possibly can to build their case, not to mention, you know, interviews with actual human beings, should they still be around, accessible, and willing to talk.
Definitely. Now, and David, bless his little heart over here, has been bugging me for about the last, 10 minutes mm-hmm. or so, to bring up your articles, I should say, in UFO Matrix magazine. I have to admit, I read the article you forwarded to me on Larry, and I loved it.
Thank you.
You did a really good job on that article. I'm proud of you on that.
Thanks. UFO Matrix is a magazine that began earlier this year, and will have its third issue out. I'm pleased to say on the racks in either Barnes & Noble's or Borders or both starting next month, I think the end of next month, which is a great breakthrough. It will join Open Minds, the magazine that comes out of your neck of the woods there in Phoenix, which is an American, obviously, publication and the first new quality UFO publication we've had come along in some years. I've written for them and look forward to writing for Open Minds more. But I'm a regular columnist in UFO Matrix, and I think Philip Mantle and Malcolm Robinson in the UK are doing a great job with this magazine. It's the first significant UFO publication with real potential impact, as far as I'm concerned, coming out of the UK since we lost Graham Birdsall and UFO Magazine, not to be confused with the American-based magazine by the same name, I think 6 years ago now, 5 or 6 years ago. And I've written for UFO Matrix now on UFOs and religion, the so-called ridicule factor in UFOs, and when I asked Philip what he was interested, if he had something special he wanted me to develop for next month's issue, and as a columnist, normally you don't ask. You talk about whatever it is that you're interested in at that time, but next month's issue, well, it's actually out in the UK now, so I can talk about it, is going to be focused on the Rendlesham Forest incident. And Philip said, you know, write why Larry still matters. And so I wrote an article called Why Larry Warren Continues to Matter relative to the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. And I thought Philip and his design team did a great layout with the material that I provided them as well. And the fact is, I was just working from collected factual material. Larry has been with us as a public presence now since late 1983, thereabouts, even earlier under pseudonym. And has never backed down about this. Needless to say, we all applaud the contributions that have been made over more recent years by Jim Penniston and John Burroughs and Charles Halt and a handful of other folks that have, you know, at least been public about their memories and accounts. But without Larry, I'm not going to say we probably wouldn't have found out about the incident. It might have been some years later, or maybe not. Sometimes you need a genuine whistleblower to rattle the cages and get things going. If he had come forward, would the other men have come forward? I don't know. But I'm glad that I had a chance to write about it.
You know, if it wasn't for Larry, we probably never would have heard of the Rendlesham incident. we probably, well, eventually we probably would have, but I think it got to us much sooner, the HALT recording.
Yeah. Most folks didn't know about how that thing popped out of the...
I thought it was kind of funny that somebody just played it for him while he was visiting
Tokyo.
In Japan.
Yeah.
It just, you know, I'd heard that, oh gosh, about 10 years ago, 10 or 15 years ago, that's how the tape got back to the States, so to speak, was through him in Japan, and it just...
Well, Charles HALT, very appropriately, has gone on record as saying that he's really angry at a number of people who, you know, he was in the service with, who he, for example, this particular officer, who without his permission or knowledge made a copy for another officer that ended up with this television producer at Nippon Television in Tokyo. And another reason why I think that... there has just never, it's just been a rough time for Mr. HALT in a number of respects on things that Larry has been free to talk about, that Charles HALT is a retired officer in good standing, and in fact a former deputy base commander, is not free to talk about, nuclear ordnance illegally held on the base complex included.
I hadn't thought of that. That could be the reason behind the animosity that HALT has for Larry.
I think the real reason is very simple, which was when Larry Warren, after he received his honorable discharge, did his best to return to civilian life, really quite changed for the experience he had had in the service and the way he was treated there, that he ultimately seeked out a credible UFO investigator, Larry Fawcett, a Connecticut police lieutenant, as well as a respected investigator, and that he essentially told Larry Fawcett everything he remembered about the events in question, who else, you know, had a part in it, what his knowledge was of their part. And when that case broke in early October 1982 on the front page of the biggest tabloid in the world in London, Larry was, his name was a pseudonym, but Charles HALT's name was Charles HALT. And he outed him. I mean, there's no other word for it. And all the other men who were involved who did not ask for it. So I even brought this up at the end of a radio show that the three of us were on a couple of months back, at the end of the show, and just said, I absolutely understood why he would feel that way, and now that we understood and that this had not helped Mr. HALT's career being associated with this subject, and, you know, I'm sure guys poked fun at him for, you know, being the UFO colonel, etc., that, you know, can't we all get along kind of thing, and I hope we can as we move into the new year.
Yeah, the HALT is last time I heard, which has been about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, was being the proverbial pain in the ass.
Well, I think he's the most complex individual that we know about in this story. He is an absolutely authentic eyewitness. His involvement has not benefited him. And he is still part of the old boys network, so to say. And especially early on, we just had a number of disagreements on things that he said about Larry that he knew were either untrue or that he couldn't back up. His concerns are about the truth, I think, like ours are, but his position is a bit more difficult. And over this past year, I think he's opened up considerably more than at any time in the past. And I only wish him well. I respect him. I admire him. Bud, and I'm sorry that he won't be able to join us in England after Christmas for this event, but the human relationships and the human dynamics in this story need to be understood as well as the non-human dynamics.
Yes, I agree. We have a question here from our virtual auditorium. This one's from David, and he asks, was the Rendlesham base closed because of ordinary military cutbacks, or was the base and its operations relocated? I can't see the military completely giving up being able to have the U.S. nuclear capability close by if needed in a conflict in the European theater.
I don't know the answer to David's question. However, I can give you some possibilities. I just don't know what the absolute truth is here, and there's no reason I should. Number one, I can accept the fact that it was decommissioned in the early 90s, I think 92, as a matter of, you know, tightening our belt a little bit. It's not the only American manned base in that part of England. But I've also heard from a source that I find credible, former Air Force in a responsible position and somebody who I trust and admire, that left at Eastgate was such a dark horse, and the fact that it became a legitimate bestseller in the summer of 1997 drew tremendous interest to the story and interest in this highly classified underground complex. And when this individual told me what I'm about to tell you, my first thought was, well, that's really weirdly, strangely, unnervingly flattering, but oh well, you know, I'm sure little old us didn't make that happen. He said he felt that the attention that the book brought to the subject compelled the Air Force to shut it down and take it off of the active list. I don't know whether that's true. It shook me up when he told me, because I feel I have to apologize to the American taxpayers for maybe a couple billion dollars being tossed there. Oops, that we could use right now. At the same time, I think this is such a strategically important location that there's no way it could have been moved. You can't move an underground complex as such. And that it may still be open for business, active and operating, well below this area that I discussed that has been made public earlier this week, underground complex on the base. And, you know, we're only limited by our imaginations in terms of the sweep of these underground facilities where entrances may be, accesses may be, how connected up they are, and I think they're much more connected than most people can or will or want to imagine. So I don't know, David. It could be as mundane as it was time to close the base. It had been open since World War II, and they felt its operations focus could best be focused into other groups, or that might have been something more extraordinary that caused the closing. Woodbridge was temporarily closed and then reopened and is a functioning RAF base again about half a dozen miles away, with the longest runway in all of the United Kingdom or Europe.
This is an interesting one from New York, really. It's more of a comment than a question. She says, if they had nuclear weapons on the base when they weren't supposed to, the publicity from the UFO case could have caused them to close down.
Well, you're absolutely right there, too, and that's a very fine point. In fact, one of the most exciting parts of Left at Eastgate, although it was not exciting or fun when it was happening, was the fact that after the State Department yanked Larry's passport for, quote-unquote, speaking out on sensitive defense issues in a public forum on foreign soil, end quote, it was former Attorney General Ramsey Clark that helped Larry and I resecure his passport, which he did absolutely gratis. What a remarkable man. And we talked to him about this nuclear versus UFO aspect of the sensitivity of the story. And I had felt that Mr. Clark would feel that it was Larry speaking out on this treaty violation and on the fact that he worked around these nukes that were not legal, and that he had had specialty training in BASIC to do just that, as had other men who worked with him, that he would fully back that it was a nuclear issue and our government getting pissed off at Larry for speaking about this treaty violation, breaking the story, basically, for the first time about 94 in Nottingham when we first talked about that there. And he said, no, I think it probably or could have just as likely, I don't remember his wording, but he thought the UFO aspect of the story might be what would have done it. And again, just say the second part of that question again.
That it was the possibility that the nuclear war weapons that were stored there when they weren't supposed to, kind of along the lines of that with the publicity.
Oh, yes. There's no question. In fact, if you study your Cold War history about the UK, there was a location called Greenham's Common, which was the center of anti-nuclear protests outside of London, as I recall, from the late 50s, I think, well into the 80s and beyond, because it was felt by the peace groups that that is where any nukes were likely to be. They were not there. They were in Suffolk under this twin base complex. And yes, you may be right. That may have been a very real factor in the decommissioning of that base. Again, I'm not good at speculating on stuff I know I can never know the real answer to, because nobody's going to tell me that actually knows it. And it's arrogant to say that you know when you don't.
It just amazes me. We went for how many years without knowing that these weapons were being stored there?
Well, that's just it. We don't know how many years. Under Reagan, I know the treaty was adjusted under Reagan and Thatcher, and under Carter, we were allowed to have something called the MX missile, to some degree, as I recall, in the UK. Some of your listeners old enough to remember might recall it only because it was launched off of a railway car. And the idea was that in times of war or national emergency, that they could have them on railway cars and come, they could just sit in a tunnel and be completely impervious, then roll that thing out, launch a missile, roll back into the tunnel. But the kind of tactical nuclear ordnance that we had in Suffolk that we understand at the time, and the late Lord Peter Hill Norton, who was a former chief of the General Staff of the Ministry of Defense, Chief of Staff, backed us up on that. And he was the greatest ally we had in the UK when he was in Parliament and spoke, asking questions directly out, drawn from Left at Eastgate, of the Secretary for Defense, book in hand on the floor of Parliament. And that was on October 28th, 1997, a very proud day for me and Larry.
My favorite quote from him, from Hill Norton, is, "If what these men are saying happened, indeed happened, then it is a great defense interest. If, on the other hand, what these men claim happened was hallucinatory or something along that line, then even that should be of defense interest."
Well, very well put, Hill Norton. In fact, the idea that the Ministry of Defense from the get-go said, whatever happened there, we're not sure, but whatever it was couldn't have been, wasn't of defense significance. That was, I think, the ministry's really the lowest moment for them on this, because, once again, they're either speaking about something that they haven't looked into or don't know, in which case that is not the most responsible statement to make, or it was and should have been considered of defense significance, but then if that is made public, then you're stuck with the sticky problem of what exactly was of defense significance, and how did it get where it got, and what is the story with that? Yeah, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't, mm-hmm. if you're a liar in this, and if you're involved in keeping the truth from the public.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
This is for me now. Out of all that's going to be happening here in it, this conference, this 30th anniversary get together.
Yeah.
What would you like to see come out of this?
Wow, Dee, good one. Well, I would love to find out that we've got a couple of other people in the audience that were also involved and that came over to England to be part of this and make themselves known and join us up on the dais. Short of that, I hope we will have a really open exchange of information, perhaps with some locals who have long-term interest in the subject. And there are many local folks who were witnesses to different aspects of this, quite a number of whom have gone on record and left at Eastgate and other locations, that maybe we'll be able to put another puzzle piece together with information that a number of people share, but that it won't have the impact unless, you know, it's triangulated and put together. I also would very much like to see all of the people involved redefine their relationship a bit. I don't know how to say it, but get closer together. Become more the brothers that they are, having gone through this life-shattering experience. Grow from it. Find peace of mind. Fight the good fight and help us continue to put the pieces together and understand what happened. And in an ideal world, continue to ram away at the impenetrable forces of the establishment and maybe make some history and have this event acknowledged. I don't think it's going to happen in, you know, this current or maybe even, you know, the next political changeover, however the weight is shifted. This is the last thing these guys want to discuss right now. But that at a certain point, these men who have suffered can get some kind of acknowledgement, apology from the government, thank you for their service, and dare I even say it, some sort of reparations for the suffering and the intimidation and the lies and the fear that they have been subjected to over the preceding three decades. I'd also like to see us all have a great time together and stay up late drinking, talking, hanging out, meeting the folks that come to the conference, making some new friends, networking more. And I would like to, you know, have a lot of the folks in your audience join the 81st website, the Facebook page, and become part of our network and this community that really is doing all it can to continue to bring responsible and serious attention on the events of December 1980 to a wider public, and to continue to fight the good fight on their own and make their own accounts more widely known. And in John Burroughs' case, bless his heart, get to a point in his regressive therapy that I think he's just been really something special, allowing clips to be shown of his hypnotic sessions with his therapist in some of his wonderful presentations with Linda Howe. There is something that frightens that big tall man very much, that he does not want to, at least allegorically, go through that door and face it.
I agree with you there. I've met John Burroughs, and yes, he's taller than I am, and I'm 6'1". And hearing him talk about this incident, you could tell he was shook up.
Yep. And when he goes, I mean, you know, you see somebody in those hypnotic regression states, I realize that most of your listeners have not sat in on this kind of thing. I have over the years and numerous times with Bud Hopkins primarily. And it can be very shattering. And to know that at some point he could get beyond that and just get back to the business of living his life, number one, following this subject, you know, being part of this great team by all means, but a little bit of peace of mind and happiness would be my first choice if there's only one thing.
Okay, we have several listeners in our virtual auditorium tonight in the UK, and actually one here, a blacklisted VIP, is saying that the 28th is his birthday and he may attend, he or she may attend. Date, time?
Yes.
Location?
Absolutely.
Price?
You got it. Here we go. The event is being billed as a 30th anniversary conference. It is going to be held on 28 December at 6 p.m. in the lovely village of Woodbridge in the community hall, and that is a Tuesday evening. Entry is £6. All proceeds, I'm again very proud to report, will go to the Ipswich Treehouse Children's Hospice, and I'm going to give you two phone numbers. The organizer is a friend of ours named Gordon Godger, G-O-O, or maybe it's Goodger, G-O-O-D-G-E-R. And anybody with any questions, and I think they're accepting reservations because we're expecting a sellout, should call the either of the following numbers, 07811-021230. I'll read that again. That's one number, 07811-021230, or this number, 01473-210726. Either of those phone numbers, and if you're able to come, come on over and introduce yourself and say we met on the Andrew's Eye to the Sky.
Fantastic. You know, I would give my eye teeth to be able to find you guys there.
I'm sorry, we're not taking eye teeth at the door. I know, sweetie. I wish you could be there, too. I really, really do. Again, I'm keeping my fingers crossed that the event will be filmed, and with any luck at all, that we'll have some kind of documentary team with us on our walks through the forest, and whatever I can get for you, I certainly will. At the least, it will be a running account, and you and I will speak sometime this week and figure out when we can get together on the air again, hopefully in January.
Well, get me one of the t-shirts and let me know how much excuse me, let me know how much it is so I can pay you back for it.
Okay, what size?
I would wear it proudly.
I'm sure they will be available in all sizes, and is there one that you would like me to look for?
A medium.
You got it.
Okay. You rock, Peter. You are just so awesome. Oh, gosh. Let's see. We've got, about a minute left. Anything you want to, last
first? Yeah, I do. I just want to take a minute to count our blessings, and it has not been the easiest of years. I've lost several dear friends. Another dear friend very ill right now. Lost Robert this week. you know, trials and tribulations are going to come and go, but right now we are coming in toward Christmas and New Year's, times of reflection, rededication, and I just want to take a moment considerably early to wish you and all of your listeners, and David, of course, a very Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah to your Jewish listeners, and a really healthy, happy New Year, one filled with love, work, and knowledge for all of us, and that is paraphrasing Dr. Wilhelm Reich.
Well, and then Happy Hanukkah to you too, Peter.
Thank you, darling.
And, you know, before we go, I do want to say one thing. This last Thursday was my grandson's 16th birthday. And I just want to say, Dar, happy birthday, kiddo.
Happy birthday, Dar.
And tomorrow is my daughter's birthday. So, Nikki, happy birthday, kid.
Wow. Happy birthday, Nikki.
And Peter, thanks again. I appreciate you joining us tonight. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It never seemed, 2 hours never seems to be long enough.
I love spending time with you on the radio, Dee, and we'll look forward to doing it again next month. A big hug to you and David. Take good care of yourselves and each other.
Oh, we will, Peter. Thanks again. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all of those who joined us in the Palbach Auditorium. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight is author Jim Elvidge. Please join me again next Saturday for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.